Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. So this evening, I thought I would talk about the five khandhas. This is the five aggregates. In Sanskrit, it's skanda, the five skandhas. And they're also called heaps, and I've heard it also described as a transient collection. I heard a Tibetan Lama Geshe call them transient collection. So the five aggregates are really important in the Buddha's teaching because, first, one of the things that's taught is this is how we identify ourselves is through these five aggregates, these five khandhas. And in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the first noble truth of suffering, well, actually it would be, well, what is dukkha? And it says the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha, are suffering. So we understand, if we understand the khandhas, we can release ourselves from suffering that comes from clinging to them. So this is why they're frequently taught. And in the Samyutta Nikaya, there's a whole section, the Khanda Samyutta, whole collection. It's one of the larger collections in the Samyutta Nikaya. So I don't think, probably not everybody here knows what the five are, so I'll list them and then talk a little bit about them and what we can do in relationship to these concepts about self. The first khanda or aggregate is form, which is the body. Pretty easy to understand why the body would be something we would identify as self. It's pretty clear. I mean, if I have a photograph of somebody, I would say, oh, that's Ayasopana. I'd recognize this image as her form, her body. And then I would say that was her. I look in the mirror and recognize me or myself or something. So this is probably, I mean, from early on in our lives, in childhood, this is like maybe one of the strongest identities we have is this body as me and mine. The second is feeling, and feeling is described as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So it's our experience, how we experience things at the senses, the six senses. So we see something and it's either we perceive it as pleasant or unpleasant, or we might not notice it because it's in the neutral range of our, it's kind of our tastes and things, our hear sounds. It may be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Same with tastes and smells. So it's kind of like how we identify ourselves through our tastes. A lot of people have really strong identity around tastes, like I like classical music or something like that. I find this thing pleasant, so this is part of my identity. And I might want to hang out with people that like the same kind of music as me, for instance. So we have form, feeling, perception. Perception has to do with recognition. So identifying things. Like I see this shape on the ground, this rectangular shaped thing, and I recognize that's a cushion for sitting on. So this is perception. And this is harder to understand as self, but it's part of what makes up how we see the world, how we perceive the world. People might perceive things differently, and we might get into arguments about, you know, some perception. So identity can latch on to perception. Then there's volitional formations, or there are mental formations. There's various ways that this is translated. I think Ajahn Tanisaro just says formations. But it's how what we, mental constructions, how we, it's more complicated of thought and volition. And the last, the fifth is the, is consciousness, and this is consciousness at the six sense bases. So the five physical awareness or consciousness at the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body would be touch, and then mental, the consciousness at the mind. It all merges at the mind, or you know, the awareness of things and how actually the volitional formations or mental formations can arise from us putting all this all together at the senses and merging at the mind. So the immediate sight sounds are awareness at them. I mean, I could be looking but not really seeing. You know, I might be, something's in my field of vision, but I might not be aware of it. Or there may be sound, but I'm not aware of it. But when there's consciousness, when this arises in relationship to it, that's consciousness at the ear. So these are the five aggregates. And they're called aggregates of clinging because we cling to them as me and mine, myself. And so this, from this, the Buddha says, suffering arises, that the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. He also says that the five aggregates are suffering without. In the other teachings, he says they themselves are suffering. And if you think about it, I mean, like, you have the body, and the body, like I'm walking and I step on a tack or something, and it hurts, so this is painful. So there's pain from the body. So that's the first... The first, like, the Buddha calls the first dart is like that experience of that physical pain. And the second would be the not wanting it. So this is like, so clinging upadana could be we want it always to be pleasant. We always want to have a pleasant feeling at the body, but that's not always so. We're clinging to the body as, like for instance, you know, in the aging process, that my body isn't able to do things that it used to. So this is painful. I'm having physical pain in the body because of a condition. And if I start saying, oh, this is terrible, why should it be this way? You know, how could this be happening to me? Things like that. Then I'm increasing the suffering. But there's like just the suffering of the body. There's just suffering by the fact that we have feeling. Or either any of the five khandhas, you know, perception or mental formations, there can be pain that arises, you know, like then, but then we add to it. Then this is where we're clinging to wanting things to be a particular way, so we add to the suffering. We add to the unpleasantness of it. So we can take any of the aggregates as a means to observe this, of seeing how we see self in it, and seeing how we cling to these ideas of self, and then see how suffering arises. I mean, this is the Buddha isn't teaching us this just to be depressing or something like this. This is like, oh, I can observe these things in myself, quote unquote. I can see how I identify. I can see how I cause suffering, or suffering arises in result of, you know, this clinging. So this is really important teaching, how to release ourselves from the suffering is really close observation. This is what we're doing when we're sitting on the cushion. We're learning to observe. We're learning to observe the body, the breath, and then we're watching the arising of thoughts. So this is the five khandhas can be divided into what's called nama rupa also. So the body or form, that's the rupa part. And then everything else is nama, everything else. It's mentality and materiality. So we're observing, we sit on the cushion, and we observe the body, and we observe the mind and see what's arising at the mind. So we can direct, you know, once we get the mind clear and settled, we can direct our mind at observing things like, how is it that I'm creating self? How is it that, and is this, another thing to observe is impermanence. So we have the three characteristics. We have impermanence, suffering, and not self. So we can take any of these three characteristics in relation to any of the five aggregates and really observe this. If we see that we're suffering, we can do it the opposite direction. Do we aware that suffering is arising? And then we could say, what's the cause of this suffering? And then I might say, oh, it's because I don't want things to be the way they are. I want my body to be a different way than it is. Let my body be healthy. Let my body be young. Let my body be, you know, more physically fit, whatever it is, you know. And I'm creating suffering for myself because I'm not wanting things to be the way they are, which is impermanent. Basically, the body is changing. There's a kanda. A teaching in the Kanda Samyutta. It's the very first one, and I've mentioned this one before. It's one of my favorite suttas. But this old man comes to the Buddha and he says, "Oh, I haven't been able to see you for so long. It's so difficult for me to come." I'm paraphrasing, because he's old. He's not able to easily come and see the Buddha, and he's, a lot of times he's not well. And so he's just like burdened with years, it's called. He's like in his 80s or something. And the Buddha encourages him, even though you're afflicted in body, don't be afflicted in mind. Oh, and so he rejoices at this teaching. He says, "Oh, this is just wonderful teaching." So he, at some level, he really understands what the Buddha is saying. He's like really excited and happy about it. Then he walks away, and there's Venerable Sariputta, who's one of the Buddha's chief disciples. And then Sariputta, "Well, where have you come from? You look so radiant and happy." And so he explains the whole conversation. And then Sariputta says, "Well, did you ask him how that's possible? How you could be, even though you're afflicted in body, you're not afflicted in mind?" And so he's, "Well, I would come a long way to hear what the Venerable Sariputta has to say about this." So he asked Venerable Sariputta to give him a teaching. And Venerable Sariputta says, "The ordinary person, when the body, goes through some kind of change, they're distressed, meaning getting older, and they resist the change, they rebel against the change, and so suffering arises from the impermanence of the body." So so he's encouraging this man to not cling to the body, not to see it as permanent, not to see it as self. And so this is the basic teaching, that we should not see the body, not grieve when there's change in the body, not to expect, this is the nature of the body to change. And it's not saying that we don't care for our bodies, but it's saying that we just know this is part of the nature of things. And then wanting things to be other than they are, wanting things that are impermanent to be permanent, is cause of suffering. So this is the basic teaching. So so we see the body and all the aggregates as not self, as impermanent, and then clinging to them is suffering. So we don't have to have that second arrow, what the Buddha talks about as the second arrow that we torment ourselves with. When things, things happen in life, and this is the nature of things to be impermanent and unsatisfactory. But then we add the additional torment, which is the clinging to things, clinging to the five khandhas as me and mine, and wanting them to be permanent, wanting them to always be pleasant, wanting, and then release the strong identification of self. There's a me. This is we're taught in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta the teaching on non-self. This is the second of the suttas. The characteristics of self, and this talks about the khandhas as not. If something is impermanent, can you really call it self? Can you really say that this is a? If something is impermanent and suffering, can you call it self? This is what the Buddha asks us to consider. And the bhikkhus that he's teaching say no. I mean, they can't consider something impermanent and suffering as self. And I think this is also based on the belief of some kind of eternal self. Where do we find this idea of eternalism is based on some kind of concept of self. And of course the body, we can't really think of as self, I mean as permanent, a permanent self. But there's some idea, there's some self somewhere in these five khandhas. Maybe the body dies, but there's some residue or something that's self. Maybe some image of this body would be eternal. And I mean, like a lot of religious beliefs of some kind of, heavenly being or something that would appear like this physical form, and that would be us, and we would have all our characteristics or something in some heavenly realm or something. I mean, there are a lot of, even like when you consider the Egyptians, they preserved the body. There's this belief that the body could, or somehow there's resurrection of the body. So there is this belief in eternalism of the body. So, and the same with the other aggregates, we may think that this is something that's eternal. So we have to really consider how even in this lifetime, all of these five khandhas are undergoing change. If we really look at what we liked and disliked as a child, is it the same? How we thought about things, it's all changing. There's nothing, and even in our adult life, we've gone through different, transformations around things, and what interests us and what we want to direct our attention to. This is all changing. This is all impermanent. So where is the self? Where can we find the self in that? And is this something we really want to cling to? So this is a in our it's a contemplation. It's something for us to explore and to examine. And the more we do the meditation practice, and the more we can work with these things, the more our mind becomes settled, and the more, the more we study and go over these things too. If we recollect these ideas, think about, if we just really think about the cause of suffering and impermanence and non-self, we could think of these just as concepts that we are exploring you know, through our experiences, through the body, through feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, we can work on it directly, or just see as it arises. We can choose one of the three characteristics to really, you know, work with for a while. Or we can, or one of the aggregates we could look at more closely. So it's up to us how we want to work with it. But it's important. It's very important to be aware of, and it's a very important aspect of the Buddhist teaching. And this is one of the ways towards liberation, is to really examine the five khandhas closely, especially in these terms, in terms of the three characteristics. So I'd like to offer this for your consideration and see what time you've got. And if Ayasobhana wants to say a few words.
Thank you, that was a very nice talk. I just wanted to, the vijnana, the consciousness, the function of consciousness is to cognize. It can be a little bit confusing the way consciousness appears in connection with the six sense bases and the way it appears in connection to the five aggregates. In terms of the six sense bases, you would think there is the internal eye faculty. That means the material part of the seeing function of the body, including the brain, because the brain is made of matter. So the brain, the nervous system, and the eye is the eye faculty. And then that's part of form. And then the external visible object is also something that's part of form. Then the consciousness then is the mental capacity to cognize a visible object. Those three things come together, and then there's an experience. They say that just from that vedana feeling arises from that, and with the vedana, craving arises. And then from craving, clinging, and then we're sort of off to the races. Now, if you think of it in terms of the five khandhas, so that consciousness, that eye consciousness cognizes the visible object, and then there's a feeling, and then the mind consciousness cognizes the feeling, based on, or possibly with the some influence coming from the feeling, there will be a perception. And consciousness, mind consciousness, also cognizes the perception. And consciousness cognizes the volition. If there's a something that moves us, and then we are either moved for or away from the object that we perceived based on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, then the volitional formation arises. So then it can be compared to a hand. There's form, feeling, perception, the volitional formations, and then the consciousness sort of goes around all of it and cognizes all of it. So the consciousness, when you think of consciousness in terms of the six senses, usually we emphasize about the five physical things, physical sense bases. But this one is really giving a much more of a breakdown of the other three elements of mentality that are also cognizant. And that vijnana in this context, when there is the self delusion, the vijnana has grasping onto things. So like a perception, you can see how perception is can be so much more painful when it's being clung to. So, like, you know, we're going to repaint this wall because some people have the perception that this wall didn't turn out good enough. And they suffer a lot because of that perception. And you know, if I perceive it this way and somebody else perceives it a different way, then, you know, that can create a conflict between people and so forth. And so if I have this eternal kind of view and I think that, you know, just because it was perceived a certain way and named in a certain way, it always has to be the same thing. But actually, what we really experience is much more shifty than that. But beyond that, the teaching that Sivijana was giving is, you know, exactly on point, that clinging to the five khandhas is the essence of suffering. And we can really investigate that. The Buddha said that dukkha should be fully understood. So then you can, if you can, whenever that clinging arises, if you can see it as it really is, and really understand it as it is, then that that's like putting daylight into a situation. And when the situation is hidden and when it's in the dark, then it's sort of like able to fester and get rancid or get moldy or get horrible. But when it's in the sun, then that the sun purifies it. And so the sun of fully understanding things as they are purifies the craving and it weakens and eventually dispels the craving. And then it might be that the clinging and craving that you had before would be replaced by a curiosity and interest, or it could be that it would be replaced by compassion. Then you no longer have are stuck in that
bond. There's a few minutes left. Does anyone have a question?
I don't know if I had a question so much as an observation. I think the way I understood it, it seems to be a very fine line between giving up on life when one says, for example, you know, I don't like my current state of health. And that is the way things are. But it seems to me you can be aware of the impermanence and still honor life by affecting change, by putting your energy into at least temporarily, if it's in your control at all, to be healthier, as an example. So that...
Yeah, it's not meant to bring up despair. It's meant to... Because despair is, why is this happening to me? It shouldn't be happening to me. Like, for instance, I have... was diagnosed with sciatica, and I go, okay, this is the condition of the body, you know, and is there something I can do about it? And so, you know, I investigate that, and there is, and, you know, it's improving, but I know, okay, the body is more delicate now because I'm older, so I just have to be, it was interesting, there was some note in that when I was talking about the sutta where the old man comes, and it talks about describing him as being burdened with years, but it also something, there was some other concept that meant like really fragile, like an eggshell. The expression was like being like an egg, or it's like a, and knowing, okay, this is part of the nature of the body. So yeah, we can't honor and care for ourselves, and knowing, like I know I can't do what I used to, but there's so many people that, you know, even in ancient times tried to resist aging and deny aging, and so we don't have to fight, you know, against it in a harmful way. It's we can certainly care for ourselves, but also eventually the body will pass away. And this is just, so we don't cause ourselves unnecessary distress or additional pain, you know, by trying to deny it, trying to, you know, fight. It's like the uphill battle or something, or, you know, just, you know, it's like certainly, I think there's a, you know, respecting the body is important as a vehicle, but also knowing, yes, this is not me, not mine, it's borrowed goods. It's going to go back to the elements where it came from. So just that, yeah.
So if I went to visit your house, I wouldn't just go in and start, you know, vacuuming and washing the walls and urinating the closet or something like that, because it's not my house. But in here in my house, I do, you know, vacuum and wash the walls and organize the closets. I think this is a metaphor for, you know, like, we still, like, we know it's not my body, but we don't feel like we're disempowered, like, we can still take care of it. But then at the same time, when you come here to this monastery, well, it is your monastery, but it's, in another way, it's not. So, as a visitor to the monastery, you can come and sort of like enjoy it, without feeling like every time there's something that you notice that's broken, that you feel a certain like distress or embarrassment or worry because there's something that needs to be taken care of. Whereas, so you kind of like, you want to be able to take care of your body like it is to your house, but also have the freedom to kind of like just appreciate the body like it's not your house, like you're a visitor occupying that body. I don't know if that makes sense. Does that help? I don't know if it doesn't help.
I also like to think of like a horse, like if somebody lent me a horse, and I have to care for the horse and feed the horse and everything, but eventually they're going to come. I don't know when they're going to come for this horse. They said, well, I'm going on this trip and you can enjoy it. It could be years, you know. And so it's not mine, but I need to, you know, take as good. And then the horse gets old.
You have to take more care of it because... Yeah. You don't want to be embarrassed.
Yeah.
For not taking care of the horse.
Yeah, and if the horse is getting old, you know, it's an old horse, I'm not going to try to ride it as hard as I used to, you know. I'm going to be more careful with this, you know, because the owner's going to come and they're going to go. Anyway.
I remember Jack Kornfield used the phrase that you have a rented body.
A rented body.
A rent a body.
Rent a body.
Yeah. You just sort of, you know, take care of it when it breaks down and give it back to the owner. When I was hearing you say, you know, so I'm going to start at the beginning. So as I understand, when to work with the aggregates or the idea of the aggregates comes up, especially in that order, is what we usually take as self, like the most gross thing, like the biggest thing, is body, is the easiest thing to take as self, and then it gets more subtle. And when I was hearing you describe, you know, I have a pain, and you normally think, oh, why is this happening to me? I wish this body would never break down. And while we know that's not true, and we want that to be true, but nonetheless, can you, it's kind of a similar question, how compassion fits in there? Because, you know, when we do the Metta Sutta, or when I think of the word compassion, I hardly ever hear it stated as, oh, may you understand impermanence better, and may you understand non-self better. It's always, you know, wishing you health and happiness, and things like that.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be contradictory. I mean, this is cultivating a particular state of mind and wishing others and oneself well, and it's to counter ill will, so this is goodwill. So, I would hope for myself for wellness, but I also understand it's not always possible. So, but I could, the ultimate wellness is the wellness of the mind and the freedom from the physical, for the mental affliction, like the sutta. So the wellness could be the wellness, wishing myself well, ultimately would be the wellness of the mind and the liberation of the mind. But we also like to think of, I mean, like, part of my love for, like, living beings, you know, I see living beings, that birds out, you know, there's this little bird that has a wounded leg, and it just holds its little leg up and hopping around just on one leg. So we start feeding the birds. And this is out of compassion, starting out with this little wounded bird. So we're wishing for the happiness and the well-being of these birds. So this is the action we have. But I can't save that bird from its suffering, really. But I'm really wishing it well, you know. And I also contemplate, well, one of these days we'll look out, that little bird won't be there anymore. We can identify it because it's the one that hops around with, so it's kind of got its identity from all the other little birds, because it's the one-legged bird, although it has two legs, it just has a wounded leg. So, you know, so I'm wishing it well, even though, it, you know, it's injured. I'm doing what I can, maybe, I don't know if it really is helpful for them to get breadcrumbs, but we would like it to be. We think it seems like they're enjoying it. The other birds are coming, you know, to join in on the taking some breadcrumbs. But I think that generating, you know, I know that generating goodwill has an effect on others. It has a positive effect on others. And I know that people aren't going to, that I generate goodwill for, aren't going to last forever. They're not going to be free from sickness and pain and stuff like that. But it helps me and it helps them. And I'm sure in all our generating of loving kindness is making an impact. So it's to counter ill will. It's to counter, you know. So it's like working in a different, you know, a different kind of arena. But ultimately, we're wishing. Go ahead.
So compassion is the desire is. the natural response of loving kindness when it encounters dukkha or suffering. So it will be the intention to alleviate suffering. So suffering is, there's all many different kinds of suffering, different levels of suffering. Like physical pain is suffering. When the doctor gives a treatment that alleviates physical pain, that could be a manifestation of compassion. And it's compassion that, you know, is directed towards the physical pain, or the, it's painful for the birds to be hungry, and so it relieves the anxiety of the birds, and it, you know, it gives them something to look forward to, because every day they come at the same time looking for their bread. And so, but then the highest compassion then is the relieve the suffering that's related to the Rama Samsara, that's related to being trapped with our afflictive mind states. And so then the mental therapy that she's talking about is really compassionate for oneself and for others, if we can bring ourselves out of delusion, or if we can help to bring somebody else out of delusion, that's very compassionate. But also, you know, taking care of the body or helping somebody to get out of physical pain or helping them to get through a time of emotional grief or to come out of some kind of mental pain, those things are also compassionate. Maybe enough?
Is that enough?
Sadhu, sadhu.